Hi, everyone, and welcome to the House of Pod. I'm Joe, and if this is your first time listening, we're a medical sort of podcast where we try to discuss medicine and health in a relatable way, and we'll answer questions you may not feel comfortable asking your doctor and definitely won't bring up to your friends. Today we have Raja Jagadeesan sitting in with us in studio, and we interview Brokaz Stewart, a travel writer, blogger, and San Francisco cult hero. Please make sure to like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes.
The opinions expressed on this podcast are broadcasted for educational and informational purposes only and do not represent the opinions of our employers. These opinions are not intended as a diagnosis, treatment, or as a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a local physician or other healthcare professional for your specific healthcare and/or medical needs or concerns.
Welcome back to the House of Pod. I'm Kaveh.
I'm Lizzie.
And I'm Joe.
And with us today, sitting in the studio, is a special guest, our first return guest, Raja Jagadeesan. He is he's an associate professor at UC Davis, and he is also the chief of education at the Sacramento VA. Is that correct?
That's right, Kaveh. Fantastic. Thank you for having me back.
Thanks for coming back, buddy. How are we doing?
We're doing really good. Joe?
I'm doing really, really well. It's good to be back. Missed a couple episodes there and just ready to rock and or roll.
You know, I think the people missed you. So I'm happy you're back.
I missed you, Joe.
I'm sure everyone is glad you're back, buddy.
And most importantly, I heard you joined a gym as your New Year's resolution.
Correct. That's great, right? But I haven't gone once yet. So
so as Nadeem said, your resolution was to join a gym and get fit. So he said, you're halfway there.
Yeah, I'm like 1% there. I disagree with him on that, but I'll take the compliment. So we'll roll with what he said.
Yeah.
Halfway there.
Well, I also have, I wanted Joe and Nadeem to contribute. So Nadeem's resolution is to rehab his knee and get back to 100% so he can remain the athlete of the House of Pod gang. So he can show me up.
I think he should be banned from forever playing basketball again. I think three surgeries due to basketball.
And you're out.
As a non-professional athlete, I think that's too many.
In my non-professional opinion, he should stop playing basketball.
Right. Raja, yeah. Any New Year's resolutions from you?
Actually, my wife and I have a wedding to go to in about a month, so we're on a weight loss challenge. We're seeing who can lose the most number of pounds in the next 5 weeks.
And what are you doing?
That sounds really unhealthy. So your New Year's resolution is to be unhealthy.
Well, the problem is, so I have a new workout buddy, and he's only into weightlifting. He doesn't do any cardio.
Oh, yeah.
So I think I'm actually gaining weight. I'm pretending that it's muscle.
But it's muscle, right.
That's exactly what I'm telling myself.
Right.
Right.
That's you're cultivating mass.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mass. That's what I'm telling myself.
Kaveh does that all the time.
All the time.
He's an expert in cultivating mass.
Oh, man. I have so much cultivated.
Anyway, yeah. For our listeners, the combination of weight bearing and cardio is known to be better than sort of one alone, right? I mean,
I do some sneaky cardio on the side. So actually my
phone.
Sneaky cardio.
Whoa, yeah,
sneaky.
Oh my
I'm
God,
pretty
I'm
sure
sorry.
Cardio, that's, you're supposed to be yeah. out in public when you do it. Not sneaky. You should be like getting all the credit.
You're making it too easy for me. I'm biting my tongue right now. It's so hard.
I feel like I'm cheating on my workout partner because he doesn't do cardio. And so I have to sneak it on the other days.
That's cute.
When I'm like doing my sneaky cardio because he's not around.
I have updates for everyone as well.
Please.
I've gone on a few dates.
Whoa.
Kaveh is like surprised, impressed, and he's something. And I, you know, sometimes I mention the podcast. It's not like the first thing I say, but it's what, you know, what I do sometimes in my free time. It's like a hobby. It's fun.
Yeah. It's how you pick up on guys. I get it.
That's what I do. Anyway, so I talk about it. And then some of the people that I've met, some of these guys have started listening to the podcast. So I just want you guys to know, gentlemen, for the show, for the sake of the show, I shall continue dating. you guys.
Take one for the team.
Soldier on, girl.
No one has said thank you yet.
I said thank you. Thank you. It's been 2 seconds.
Thank you. Yes. That's a great excuse for you to get out there and date a lot. No shame in that. You don't, first of all, you don't need an excuse. You should go out there. You go, girl. You live. But yeah, I mean, you might as well be productive.
Yeah, exactly. It's like two for one, right?
How soon into the dates do you drop that you're in a podcast?
Well, because it's so impressive, as soon as possible.
No, I'm going to try that.
I don't know.
No,
really,
seriously, it's date one. Yeah.
Wait.
It's first date,
right.
I'm sure.
Right.
Exactly.
So, Joe, when you're out and you're talking to people, I mean, you're the unmarried male.
Yeah, I'm learning from Lizzie. I'm going to go all out with this idea. I do it a little bit. I throw it out there, but not.
Do you do it like
I don't
subtly?
Utilize enough. Definitely not enough.
You kind of like just drop it like, you're like, oh yeah, I got to go home doing a podcast early tomorrow morning.
Right. Or same with the band drummer thing. Mm-hmm. I throw that out as much as I
which,
can.
Which seems to work better?
Neither.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
I have something to talk about. I have had a recent experience as a patient, not as a doctor, but as a patient. So as you guys probably know, and the astute listener can hear, I have some sinus issues. I developed something called eustachian tube dysfunction. So this
it's
is
like
not,
herpes.
It is a problem in the middle ear. Now, the middle ear is essentially this air-filled cavity, and it connects to the back of your throat through an opening that periodically opens and closes.
Is that the palate?
No, but it's not far darn from it. That. Anyways, the point is, when your ear pops, part of that sensation is because of the opening and closing of this valve that allows that pressure to be released. Now, unfortunately, for some reason, and it's not really quite clear why this happens, that can go astray. And so for me, that valve stopped working. So that ear, have you ever like been like half your head is like you come out of a pool and you have like water in your ear and you kind of shake it out? This is like if that water never comes out. So eventually it got better with some treatment. But for a while, I couldn't hear out of my left ear. I couldn't like, it was very disorienting because I felt like half my head was underwater. It was really awful. I mean, on the scale of things, there's things much worse, obviously. But I mean, I went to go see a doctor for this. Now, here is where it gets a little interesting, is because it's good for doctors every now and then to experience things from the other side. So I go into this room, and this doctor was kind enough to fit me into their schedule. I wasn't on their schedule, but they fit me in, which was very nice. A bit of professional courtesy, which is a whole other topic we should talk about at some point. But I go in to see this person, and the person comes in with like a crew of like six people following them, like some doctors following them, some nurses following them, and they lay me on a table.
Not trainees.
Those are interns.
Not interns. There were just some other doctors shadowing this doctor, trying to learn from this doctor, and there was like three nurses trying to like learn from this. And so they lay me on a table. I'm surrounded by these three like doctors, three women doctors, like all around my head. And they start to examine my ear. There's not a lot of foreplay that's going into this. It's just basically right
like,
into
I'm
it.
Like how, there's just probing. Just lots of probing.
This is right to the probing. And I understand there's not a lot of time. We got to figure out this. They want to get to the root cause. They want to see what's going on. But, you know, you're a little nervous. You're like, oh, what's going on here? And then people start poking and prodding. And they're actually, like, looking in my ear. And they're, like, examining my ear. Mm-hmm. And they're like, this is not going to hurt. I'm like, yeah, it really hurts. And they're like, it just doesn't hurt. I'm like, it really does.
No, it doesn't.
Right.
You're mistaken.
Yeah. And I'm like, it really hurts. And then, like, they're like, don't move your head. And I'm like, yeah, okay, well, I'm not going to be one of those guys that moves their heads. And then they move like this thing in my ear, and I move my head because I can't help it because it's like a reflex. This thing in my ear, it really hurts. Oh my, I'm the difficult patient. How did this happen? How did it come to be that I'm the difficult patient?
Did you feel like a wimp when they told you?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I did. Trust
that's
me.
The worst part
it didn't
of it.
Feel good.
Right. When they're like, no, this shouldn't hurt. And you're like, yes, it does.
It really hurt though, to be fair.
Yeah.
It was a good reminder. I mean, I like to think that I've had enough experiences as a patient or a family member of a patient before this to have sympathy for my patients, but it is a good reminder to be on the other side of things and to realize that what we consider to be very casual experiences is not for the patient.
Yeah. When we, before we do colonoscopies and upper endoscopies, we always consent people, and sometimes they're so nervous and you're just like, you're going to be fine. You know, there's nothing you can really say to someone who's that nervous. And when you do the procedure, you can see someone grimacing. And we have the luxury where we can just give more medication, you know?
Usually.
And the worst, usually, unless their vital signs aren't great. And there are, you know, once or twice a year, there's someone who's sort of asleep in that sort of sleep state, sleep wake state that you don't know what they're remembering or quite feeling because they're a little sedated. And then a couple times a year again, they'll start crying. I've had a couple patients who've just cried, and it makes me like obviously very uncomfortable and a little sad.
Well, yeah, a lot sad.
Yeah. And again, they don't look like they're in pain, but they're just clearly dreaming or something. And sometimes afterwards I'll say, how are you okay? How are you doing? They're like, oh, I'm fine. It was great. And they just don't remember anything because one of the medications we use, Versed, which is midazolam, has amnesia properties. So intentionally, you know, because we want people, if they need another colonoscopy in the future, in the near future, in the distant future, we want them to be able to come back without too much PTSD or, you know, bad memories of it. So those are sort of the worst experiences.
I think that's a really good story, actually, because, you know, as a patient, I think we can often feel like we're just in a petri dish. Like in your situation, you got 10 people looking at you, probably pointing at you like you're a little frog.
And they're pointing at my penis too. And I'm like, what does that have to do with anything?
And then you have the pain and you feel embarrassed. You feel embarrassed because of the pain and you don't want to whine and everything. And it's a bad experience for the patient. And I wouldn't want to be in that situation.
You feel judged when people are telling you that it shouldn't hurt and you're experiencing or anything like this. You're normal and you're like, but I don't feel normal.
Right.
You know, people feel judged. They feel like they're not being heard or not believed. And this is something that I think we experience in the office all the time.
Now this is a problem for patients who have diseases that are not obvious diseases, like patients with fibromyalgia. I mean, all they get told is that like,
there's nothing,
you're fine. You know, maybe they're told it's in their head. Mm-hmm. And sure, there might be some component of stress and anxiety that makes all pain worse, but clearly there's something that's bringing these people in. There's some pain that they're feeling that's very real, you know, at least to them it's happening. So it's important for us to remember that. And I wish I had not gone through that, but I guess it's a good thing that I did.
It's really interesting because I think it brings up a couple things in my mind, which is, you know, first, as physicians, we get exposed to things that we consider like kind of what we consider serious, quote unquote, which is, you know, life-threatening things. We see all sorts of crazy things. Then when we get to one of these, quote unquote, routine procedures, in our minds, we go into that interaction and we are already sort of minimizing it already. And this is, out of my 8 things to do today, this is the easy. This is the least invasive and least stressful thing.
This is the least sick person.
This is the least sick person today. But it's really important to realize, but for that person, this is the most intense thing they're going to have that day.
Right.
And so for us, we're like, this is not a big deal.
Right.
But I mean, it's really interesting to kind of have that experience on the other side.
Yeah.
The other thing is kind of like, you know, I think one thing that we don't talk about enough, I think, for physicians is kind of empathy fatigue, which is, you know, we see people at their worst all day, every day, day after day. And of course, we are empathetic people. Otherwise, we probably wouldn't have gone into medicine. But there is some empathy fatigue. How can you empathize with every single complaint?
Right.
When out of the 50 complaints you see this week, that's the quote unquote least of them, right?
Yes, evil Cave. I agree with that.
Bizarro Cave. But it's true because if someone's so worried, you want to say, I don't actually know, every person's different. I want to say, I've done 1,000. This is routine for me. This is not a big deal. But at the same time, like you said, it is a big deal for them. So I don't know how to empathize. Sometimes I look at them. I try to sort of get a sense, like that sort of emotional IQ that you know we talk about. But I try to see what's going to make them calm. Like I'm very confident, but I don't want to be arrogant. Yeah. This is routine for me, but it's not routine for you. You know what I mean? It's just sort of like all these dichotomies that you're trying to reconcile to make the patient comfortable.
True. Because you do want them to feel like this is a routine thing to some degree.
Right.
Yeah, no, I hear you. It's funny how certain things sound so different from the opposite end of the table. Like, for example, before a procedure, we talk about risk.
Yeah.
And sometimes we'll say there is a risk of something happening here. And, you know, in some cases we'll say it's about 1 in 100, which to us, if we say that routinely enough, we feel confident in our abilities. We feel confident doing it. We don't think of that as a scary number. But if you're a patient and you hear 1 in 100, you're like, holy hell, 1 in 100, that easily could be me. Mm-hmm. I'm 1 in 1,000,000. I could be 1 in 100. So it's much scarier from the other side to hear those.
Right.
But you have to at the same time. Yeah. Like, we have to tell patients about the risks.
Yeah.
Especially if they're walking in. You know, we, again, do procedures all the time where patients tell their primary care doctor, I have this symptom. And the primary care doctor books a colonoscopy or an upper endoscopy. And they might not know fully, even though we send them emails and paperwork, this is what to expect. Because a few weeks ago, I had a patient where I said, we're about to do this upper endoscopy. There are risks. And she goes, oh. And I said, they're very rare, less than 1 in 1,000. I do the whole kind of, we all have a spiel. And she goes, oh, there are risks. I don't want this.
Right.
And I said, and my jaw sort of dropped because she's already in the unit to do the procedure with an IV in her arm, who has woken up early and hasn't eaten. And, you know, is this whole thing. I'm like, how do you get this far into this day and then say no? And in the end, we had a very long conversation. It took 5 times as long as the actual procedure took.
Yeah.
And she decided to do it. But her initial instinct was, oh, there are risks? No. And it's just, you know, everything has risks, you know?
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
So it was very, that was a surprise to me.
Coming up next, we have Stuart Shuffman, otherwise known as Broke Ass Stuart. He's an SF cult hero, blogger, and travel writer. Stick around, it's a good interview. All right, on the show with us today, we have Stuart Shuffman, otherwise known as Broke Ass Stuart. He's an SF cult hero, a blogger, travel writer, and star of Young, Broke, and Beautiful. He also has a podcast. It's called Weird and Wonderful. And where can people find that?
On the internet.
Fantastic.
Excuse me, where?
Yeah,
the internet.
It's a little place called the internet.
I don't understand.
That's it.
It's called Weird and Wonderful with Broke Ass Stuart. That's me. So, yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for having me here.
So, we have a lot to talk to you about.
Sure.
Let's start back in 2015. So you ran for mayor of San Francisco.
This is correct.
Tell us a little bit about why you did that.
Well, I did it because a lot of things. It was protest. It was street theater. It was political theater, and it was a good time. You know,
was it really?
We imagine politics to be a real sort of drag. There's some positive aspects to it.
I didn't have to worry about winning because I wasn't going to win.
So
it makes it much easier when like.
What would have happened if you won? What if a Trump happened and like, oh my God, here I am.
Did you just use a Trump happened?
He's obviously not a Trump, but what if like there was a surprise win and you actually won? What would that, would you have actually been like, forget it, I'm out of here? Or you'd been like, oh, let's do it.
Well, we would have had an amazing inauguration party. And it would have gone very quickly downhill after that. Well, my thing is like, what scandal? There's nothing I could do to get me in trouble because the biggest scandal of all would be me getting elected.
Right.
So it's probably hard to beat that.
Yeah, right.
But was there any, obviously, so it's fun, there's theater, good. But was there some policy? Was there, what's the platform that is the most important to you for San Francisco?
Well, a big part of it was that, like, by running as a protest candidate, you can shed light on issues that aren't going to be talked about otherwise. And I already have a large platform, so it was easy to direct people in different ways. We live in San Francisco, so homelessness was a huge part of it.
Right. Yeah.
What to do? I live at the corner. I would say I live at the corner of needles and diarrhea. I live in Soma, and there's a lot of horrible things. People are living in ways that they shouldn't be living in, and it's sad that they have to, and that we don't have better structures to deal with that.
Right.
So dealing with that, even literally dealing with the needles and diarrhea, it was like, why don't we put up little bathrooms for them? It's really easy, and we thought of really cool, creative ways to do it.
Yeah.
One of them was the idea, for right now, if you look up, you see all those cranes in the sky that are building buildings.
Yeah.
1% of all those buildings, it goes to public art, right? So I said, why don't we just put another 1% on and put that to public bathrooms?
Mm-hmm.
And
then, in those buildings?
No, anywhere.
The money from that.
Right, 1%, right?
Yeah.
Which is like, let's say there's 10 cranes in the sky right now, and let's say each one of those buildings is $100 million. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of fucking bathrooms.
Yeah.
And then you can fuse the two and build these public bathrooms with the art money too and make them look amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you live on the corner of Needles, Diarrhea, and I've smelled a lot of urine in that area too.
Oh, yeah.
How are you involved in what organizations to change it? Are you doing this is medical focus, like needle exchanges? And we had a guest on a few weeks ago talking about his bipolar disorder. And we talked about how, you see people walking the streets who might have been this home, this Nebraska corn fed privileged white kid. And now they're like on the streets, shirtless, shoeless because of mental health, mm-hmm. So clearly mental health, housing, needle exchange, these are things that are so important, right?
A lot of them are tied together, too.
Yeah.
The best, I've thought about this a lot, and I think the best thing that I can personally do is what I do, and I feel like I do it well, is I amplify voices that don't always get heard.
Mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and that's the what I can offer the best. Like, I'm only one person. I only have so much time and very little money. So, like, what I can do best is help you get your message out there.
Right.
So that's kind of like where I look at my point is in the struggle.
Yeah.
I try to volunteer my time when I can. I try to, like I said, the shirts, t-shirts that I sell, I try to, you know, if they're like, you know, somewhat, social justice related or politically related, give a portion of those t-shirts to, causes, you know?
Yeah.
But, that's really where I feel like my role is. But I mean, I've done a lot of stuff when the Super Bowl was here in 2016, I think, which was another travesty. You know, the mayor, Ed Lee, he basically said, you know, there's all these cameras that are going to be in town, and we're throwing a party for a fucking football game that's happening 50 miles away. And all these homeless people who we haven't taken care of, instead of taking care of them, they just pushed them all underneath the freeway. There was a 1 mile long encampment, right? Because they didn't want to be seen as the city with this homelessness problem, which we absolutely have. Mm-hmm. And so I teamed up with the Coalition on Homelessness to throw this big protest. And, you know, we there's thousands of us out there carrying tents, because at the same time, they're like, you know, the thing is, you can't put your tent up here. So we just carried our tents with us. It's kind of like, where can we put down our tents?
Yeah.
And we got coverage from every publication around the world. You know, kind of being like, this is San Francisco, guys. This is a problem. And they just literally swept it under the freeway.
Yeah.
So, you know, I looked at things like, how can we make, you know, like, I can't fix the things, but I can make a spectacle about them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because we, as, you know, we've talked as doctors, like, how do we, you know, fix things? How do we, you know, engage and change? Because it's hard to have a voice. You know, mm-hmm. you can make a stink, and we're trying to, you know, think about that, especially with our listeners. You know, your t-shirt says, fuck your thoughts and prayers. You know, what's the role of the medical community, again, that's what I think about, in gun violence and policy, and how much do we get involved in stuff like that? You know, it's, we all have opinions, but it's hard to sort of organize and affect change.
Well, the problem, the scariest part about all that right now, and this is something that I imagine you all would see, especially looking at the public sphere, is that, like, people are no longer understanding or willing to take facts as facts. You know, like, you could piss in somebody's mouth and they'd be like, Rush Limbaugh says it's water. You know, like, that's not piss. You know, it's like, so, factually speaking,
yeah,
guns are a health problem for our country.
Right.
You know, factually speaking.
Right.
Numbers wise. But people will spin that to be like, oh, fuck the governments, man. They're going to try to get you, you know, like.
Where do you get your health care?
Obamacare.
Okay. Just curious.
Mm-hmm. And how have you found it? Have you found it to work?
Yeah. I mean, I'm standing, aren't I?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
well, you're sitting, actually.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah, you're alive.
Standing, occasionally standing.
You know, he's capable.
When I'm forced to, I will stand.
For the listeners.
Today, I walked a little bit.
capable of standing.
Yeah. I think that we need a better system, but I don't think fleshing the whole thing down the drain is the answer. I think we need a single-payer healthcare system. I think we need universal healthcare like every other developed nation in the world. Even fucking Peru, which is, you know, a developing country, has single-payer healthcare. I don't know how well it works, but they have it. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's absurd that, like, we have that, like, you know, I was earlier today, I was thinking about this with this, with the gun thing happening, and these people who are like, we need guns to protect us from the tyranny of our government, right? Those guns haven't protected the government from breaking the unions, haven't protected them from privatizing prisons, hasn't protected them from making healthcare unaffordable, hasn't protected them from selling out our law books to the corporations. Mm-hmm. The tyranny's already happening, dude. You know, like, the guns ain't doing shit but killing each other. So we need a more socialistic viewpoint if we're going to survive as a nation, I think.
There was an article in New England Journal a few months ago that Prissa actually pointed out to me, that was all about, you know, if we identified something that was killing whatever the stat is today, like a million Americans a year, we would be, like, getting the vaccines and investing money and all this, you know, but, you know, gun violence is doing that. It's like, you know, sort of an epidemic, and it's like a virus that's not sort of going away, and we're not investing time or money or doing the right things or resourcing it appropriately. Who knows what the answer is, but we're not doing a great job, you know?
Well, look how few Islamic terrorist attacks happen in America, right? Yet there is so much effort into fighting that. Yeah. There are more toddlers that kill people every year than there are Islamic terrorists. But we're not attacking toddlers yet.
Yet.
Little bastards.
Never know. Never know.
You know, it's true. I mean, there's statistics that we'll pull out. I mean, you talk to someone who's very pro-gun. They have their own set of statistics. But they're pretty obvious. They show that, like, number of deaths, for example, due to in-home sort of attacks, like home invasions, is like maybe 430 a year. the number of people per year in the United States that accidentally kill themselves or shoot themselves with a discharged gun is 500. The number of people who die because of stairs every year is like 2,000.
Right. Don't even get started with car accidents or anything like that. Or
and then what's the statistic with domestic violence and guns? I mean, that's another astounding statistic too. I mean, guns used against people that you love. Yeah. You know, it's awful.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's some correlation between people who like commit these mass acts of violence and like abuse in like spousal abuse or something along those lines.
Yeah.
Let's talk about marijuana.
Yeah.
So, it's explained to us a little bit about what's happening here in the city with state and federal law. I know you follow this subject pretty carefully. Can you explain to us what's happened recently?
Federally, marijuana is still a Schedule I drug, which means it has no medical value and can't even be tested on. Locally, it's legal for anybody 21 and older to buy it.
It's challenging also as a physician because I have patients who email me, hey, do you know about cannabis with my belly pain or this or that? And I'll say, you know, we don't have a lot of data. It's sort of frustrating because people, I'll say I can't recommend against it. You know, I don't have data that says it's going to hurt you. Again, smoking versus eating, we could talk about that stuff. But, you know, I also don't have data that says it's going to help you. You know, it's a hard position to be right now because it is legal in San Francisco.
Well, and the whole history of why marijuana is illegal is tied to racism too. It was associated with black jazz musicians and Mexican migrant workers, you know, and they're like, well, it's the devil's weed. Look at the kind of people who use it, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it's like so many of our drug laws are racially based, you know, look at what happened. I mean, I don't know if you all know in the 80s and 90s, they only repealed this law recently. Crack cocaine and powder cocaine had different, different
sentencing. Yeah.
And because crack cocaine was considered a black person's drug, a poor person's drug, you know?
Yeah.
So a lot of these drug laws are racially motivated.
So just from a practical standpoint, so what is it safe for someone to buy here? They can buy here in San Francisco, no problem. But then if they're caught with it somewhere else, it's illegal. Like, how does that work? If they're like, someone finds them, a cop pulls them over, and they're crossing state lines or something, then it's a problem.
But isn't also how much you buy? Or?
It's state by state. So even before it was fully legalized here in California, it's been decriminalized since the 90s. So you could have an ounce or below, as long as it wasn't subdivided into like three or more bags.
Yeah.
And I used to get in trouble a lot for that when I was younger.
That implies intent to sell or distribute or whatever.
So it was personal use, ounce or below. It was a misdemeanor and a fine. Mm-hmm. But you know, every state's different, you know, on the West Coast, we cool, you know, like Oregon, Washington, California legalized up and down. Mm-hmm. Alaska's legal, Hawaii, it's legal, Colorado, it's legal, DC, it's legal, you know, it's happening. But
it's really hard when it's federal versus state versus city or whatever it is, and unrolling it at different times and intervals because there's all these other consequences. Like speaking of guns, like if you have a gun and you're caught with weed because, you know, it's all about the federal consequences and it's just there. It's really hard to sort of navigate right now. And if you want to grow some in your backyard, there's laws, you know, or put it in your food and sell it. It's just not that easy yet.
I mean, if you're not dealing with the FDA, you know, I mean, really right now, it's a pretty golden time to be doing anything in cannabis. And you're seeing, it's an interesting part of it is you're seeing all these people who wouldn't touch it 6 years ago, 5 years ago, all these guys who would be in Wall Street 5 years ago, 6 years ago, who are vultures coming into it. And mm-hmm. you're going to see it. The disruption that's going to be happening in cannabis is not going to be good for the people who've sweated and went to jail and worked hard for the past 30 years. Opportunity for Teamsters or SEIU or something like that to go in and organize and unionize everybody working in cannabis. Because mm-hmm. in 5 years, Marlboro's coming in, you know?
Yeah, right.
So, and then how do you fight against that?
Yeah,
you know, unless you're unionized and organized.
Right, yeah. Right.
You know, it's interesting. I know a person at UC Davis who does cannabis research. And so there is some research, but the hoops that you have to jump through right now to do federal research on cannabis is really hard. So
it's absurd.
He's part of a consortium. There's 10 research labs across the country who are authorized legally to use cannabis in research.
Who sells them their pot?
Good question. So there is one legal place to grow pot federally. It's the University of Mississippi. They have a legal pot farm. It is the only one that the DEA has actually authorized, and they grow it for these 10 labs, and that's it. So that's the bulk. That's the research.
The funny thing is, I feel like Mississippi is one of those states where one seed gets you in jail too.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't have told it out. Maybe I shouldn't have said that out loud. They're gonna shut it down.
I'm sure people have found out already.
Yeah. We're recording from Mississippi next time,
right?
But I mean, but he's been finding some really interesting things. I mean, so he's been trying to, you know, separate out the psychoactive effects from the actual medicinal effects and using it in different kind of concentrations. And he's found that it actually takes a very low concentration to actually get some of the medicinal effects, like not for nausea or pain control. Like, you don't need to get high per se to actually alleviate some of those symptoms.
There's a whole bunch of stuff that's either very high CBD or like no THC at all. It's all CBD. And then whether it's the, you know, bud, the flowers that you smoke, or pills, edibles, balms and salves, you know, like all kinds of stuff for joint pain, for all kinds of maladies, you know. And and it's absurd that we know this works. And, you know, and granted, you also have the pharmaceutical companies that have been against this shit for a long time because they know it has properties that are good for people, that are, help heal people. But, you know, we let the corporations run all over us.
Let me ask you this. What would you, I know there's people out there who aren't necessarily against the use of marijuana, but they'll say, I don't want there to be a marijuana shop in my neighborhood. I don't want a marijuana shop next to my place. What would you say to those people? Is there any benefit to the community? Would you say that it's just something that you have to deal with living in a free society? What would you do to convince those people it was worthwhile?
Well, these things are being massively taxed. I know with Colorado, the taxes are going into the schools. Mm-hmm. But I mean, what you have here, what we are on the precipice of right now, is an entire, a boom is not even the right word for what's going to happen. So Colorado's got a population of what, like 5 million or something like that? California's population is like 50 million. We are so much bigger, and we're going to have this tourism. Like, there's going to be so much money that comes into the state. Mm-hmm. That could go into our fucked up school systems, that could go into, you know, maybe funding housing for the homeless, mm-hmm. you know, build more navigation centers. There's a lot of this stuff this money could go to. Whether or not it's going to go there was the whole other story.
Yeah, sure.
But I mean, and what are you worried about is my question. I mean, people smoking weed.
Yeah. And also it's like a liquor store.
Exactly.
Are people worried about having a liquor store next to their house?
Yes, they are. Yes.
Well, then sell it in the liquor stores. I don't
know. Corner store.
But here's the thing. As marijuana, as they roll out more and more permits for people to sell recreational weed, you're going to have the same, like a decriminalization process where things like, there's just going to be less violence around it. So like, I mean, the one thing I would worry about is that, you know, violence because of that, you know, because back, you know, when shit was, I mean, right. I grew up with a lot of drug dealers and like, you know, big drug dealers, and they had guns and they had bulletproof vests and they had pounds and pounds of drugs, and violence was real, you know. But when you take away the black market aspect of it, right, that violence disappears. The cartels, part of the reason, I mean, I don't know if you all know this, there's a huge opioid crisis going on, and it's not just the stuff that's from pharmaceuticals. The cartels are pushing cheap heroin right now. Mm-hmm. That's why you've seen so many more needles, right? So because they're not making money on weed anymore. So they're pushing speed and heroin. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that's because of the legalization and decriminalization of marijuana.
Yeah.
If we decriminalize all drugs and make it a healthier way to deal with it instead of putting people in jail and we try to fix their lives instead of break their lives more, we could see a lot less violence.
Right. Yep. It'd be interesting to compare the Portuguese model, for example, where they decriminalized drugs, but they made it a mental health issue. And they pose it as a mental health issue. So it's not necessarily against the law, from my understanding, but it is something that they would consider to be a mental health problem.
Using drugs at all.
Yeah, I mean, addiction is
sort of, because you're self-medicating to some extent. But that's very sort of errs on the side of being very generous, because I'm sure some of it is criminal, some of it's mental health, some of it's boredom.
We're going to be opening... It might be the first in the nation safe injection site here in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Where? Probably the Mission or Soma, I think. I mean,
That's just a space where people can shoot up and get clean needles.
Clean needles, and there's services there. Yeah. And it's a place for people to be. Because also, like, especially when you're dealing with like drugs like heroin, it makes you a very vulnerable person. If you're nodding off, it's very easy to get beaten up, taken, robbed, raped, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's just a safe place to do this stuff where there's services and people there who can help you as well.
Oh, that's cool. Great. There should be hopefully sexually transmitted disease testing as well.
Absolutely. But, I mean, Hep C goes along with needles. And I mean, there's a lot of problems.
I think that I totally see the benefit of that. But then again, I would see the same question. How would you feel if that was opening up next door to you?
That's different. I don't know why, because marijuana now, purchasing on the corner, is legal. Buying heroin is still illegal once you have it and you're shooting it. You know, it definitely will encourage people who are using heroin to be in your neighborhood, which is apparently different than people smoking weed. You know, or
they're already in my neighborhood.
Weed.
They're already there.
Exactly.
They live in tents outside my door.
That's true.
They're already there. Why don't we try to make their lives better?
Yep.
Yeah, but it is sort of a judgment, right? You're saying that someone who smokes weed or eats, or I'm saying that smokes weed or eats weed is different than somebody who's shooting up heroin. And I don't know if that's true. Maybe there's a fundamental similarity, but there's clearly a difference when someone's willing to do illegal activity sort of in public than...
There's more danger for sure. I think from a health standpoint, you're not going to overdose on weed. But heroin, you could easily
if
you take too much. So.
Well, also, it's a place where you can probably distribute Narcan as well, which is the thing that Narcan, I think it's pronounced Narcan. It's the thing where if you OD and somebody administers that to you, it stops your OD.
Right.
It saves lives.
For a few minutes, and then it kicks in again. You have to give it again. It's a very short acting, but it totally reverses the effects of opiates. So.
You know, I had this thought, kind of going all the way full circle back to your thoughts on gentrification in the city in terms of, you know, so I would actually go from the other side, which is I think that one of the reasons people don't want it in their backyard is property values. I mean, if in this city, property values are enormous.
Sure.
So people are willing to go to the mat to protect their multi-million-dollar, 400 square foot, whatever, or God forbid if they have a high rise that's worth multi-billion dollars, whatever. So I think if you had like, you know, a pot store versus a clean needle injection site or whatever, I mean, they're going to fight tooth and nail if their perception is that's going to directly impact how much my building is worth or whatever. But on the flip side, though, people don't have that problem with wineries. If a winery opened up on your street, that'd be a plus, right?
Sure.
Because it's the way it's packaged. It's the way, I mean, is it nice? Is it, does it
perception,
bring in a higher class of people? Is it, you know, but you could just say alcoholism is as bad as
these
whatever.
Are artisanal needles.
Right. Right. So
free range needles.
You know, it's funny. So I'm just raising this, like, you know, what if you actually went from the other side, like approach developers. Say, how do you make a pot store that would add value to the neighborhood instead of subtract value?
Sure. There's a high range of pot stores. There's like the Apothecarium feels like you're in the lobby of the Ace Hotel.
Right.
You know, but
right.
then you have like ones that feel like you're in a liquor and deli. Mm-hmm. You like, want some chips with that, pal?
Right.
You know, like,
right.
So there's a spectrum. I think, to be honest, I think the issue is we need to get to the point where people are actually backing up what they espouse, right? It's easy to be progressive on Facebook.
Yeah.
But fucking put your money where your mouth is. Do you want to solve actual problems?
Yeah.
Then be willing to fucking do that and be okay with that, you know? Because that's what it takes. It takes us being like, okay, well, my $2 million place might be worth $1.8 million instead, you know? Like, there's so much greed and so much money.
Yeah.
And like how much more do you need?
Yeah, that's a really good way to wrap it up. Stu, thank you, Stuart. Sorry, yeah. Stuart. Stu.
I've been called worse.
Broke-ass.
Yeah. Broke-ass.
Right.
May I call you broke-ass?
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Where can people find you?
All over the internet is broke-ass Stuart. That's all the handles that are that. It's me, pretty much. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. If you like what I say, you like my ideas, and you want to help support independent media, I've got a Patreon page. And for those who don't know Patreon, it's a way that you can support creators by, you know, kicking in $5 a month, $10 a month, and you get cool perks out of it too. So please support.
All right. Thank you so much to our guest, Broke Ass Stuart. And if you guys have any questions out there, remember our number, 408-444-6623. That's 408-444-6623 or hopquestions@gmail.com. We may not get to your question right away, but we promise you we do care about answering all of them, and we will get to them.
All anecdotes and patient-related details were changed with respect to date, sex, and certain details so that patient identification is not possible.